I think it might be fair to say that the Somme battle was, in a sense, one of the watersheds of the war. And what I have in mind is that the scale of the preparations for the Somme battle were, of course, absolutely vast. It was an attack that Haig saw as having possibilities of a decisive blow in defeating the Germans. And the scale of the operation as it was built up was entirely out of proportion to the actual results which were achieved. And I always feel with the Somme battle that it was the beginning of the more overt forms of political criticism of Haig's leadership. Well, that's the thing which one reads about most frequently, and I often wondered in reading that whether people in the position of yourself as quite junior officers, whether their reactions to the Somme and the lack of progress that it made were of the same kind or not. Well, what I'm saying really is, are these things which one knows had a political demonstration in the kind of reactions Haig received after the Somme battle? Well, was there any kind of that criticism at the sort of junior officer level?
No, I don't. I don't think we've felt that at all. We went into each phase of the battle, hoping for success, and if we had a local success, we were pleased about it. I think I perhaps was lucky in the division I was with, 56 London Division, because they never failed completely. They had some frightfully bloody attacks to carry out with only limited success, but they always had some success. And I don't think I ever came across any, what shall I say, defeatist feeling in the brigade I was with. Nor did I ever hear or feel any disgruntlement at our high command.
But clearly, the results must have been a disappointment
Oh,
there.
yes. Oh, yes. One always hoped, one always went in hoping for some big success.
And presumably, with the kind of build-up that had taken place, your expectations at the outset of the battle were quite high.
Yes.
Another
But
aspect of the Somme battle, which is of outstanding importance, is of course the introduction of the tank.
yes.
Were any tanks brought into the operations at your point on the front?
Yes, in September, we had a rehearsal with tanks before they first went into the battle, and of course everybody was very impressed and thought something terrific was going to happen. But when it came to the first use of them on our front, we had a terrible disappointment because they failed completely. The three tanks allotted to my brigade, only one broke down before it reached the front line. One broke down in the front line. Only one got across the front line, broke down before it reached the German front line. So they were a complete failure. But just to the north of us, there was a tank had a great success
Yes.
at a place called Flers.
Now, after the offensive had failed, and by September or so, winter was beginning to set in, you became engaged on consolidating such gains as had been made, and preparing, presumably, for the renewal of the offensive, if it should take place. What kind of work was involved in consolidating the areas that had been gained? There was some patrol work, I believe you mentioned.
The patrol work I was talking about was principally, that was patrol work between the different offensives in the Somme battle.
Oh, I see.
That was patrol work, going out in front of our front line to lay out and prepare assembly trenches for the next attack. And on one occasion, flank trenches to join up with the French right near the bend of the Somme River.
Mm.
And there we had to go out a long way in front of our, to the flank of our front line, and met the French troops who were to join up with and prepare to do a combined attack, so the next attack.
These assembly trenches you were working on, were they new assembly trenches which had to be dug, or were they conversions of German trenches that you had taken over?
New assembly. Both might happen, but the things I'm thinking of, when we went out at night doing a reconnaissance for them, they were new assembly trenches dug in no man's land after the Germans had withdrawn some distance, and more especially to get a suitable line to start our next attack from, because the last attack that we where we had advanced might leave a very irregular line with our troops just dug into shell holes, and you must have some suitable line. Of the form of attack of those days, you must start off from a fairly straight line. To give your troops a chance in a dawn or pre-dawn attack, give them a chance of going off in the right direction. So always you try and get a more or less straight line to start off from.
I see.
And so usually, very often it was the laying out and digging of a shallow trench in no man's land.
Yes. The trenches that you had to build in no man's land, was this work done by the engineers or by the infantry themselves?
Oh, by the infantry themselves.
Mm-hmm.
There might be a few engineers to help lay them out and mark them out, but the infantry themselves would do the digging.
Mm. Now, there's one reference in your book which particularly interests me, when you refer to a meeting you had with Brigadier General Duplessis.
Yes, he is.
Yes. Now, you referred to the fact... See, Duplessis became quite significant after the war, didn't he?
Do I say that? Or I don't know.
I wondered whether when you talked to Duplessis, you got any impressions from your conversations with him about Verdun and the French army, whether you got any impressions from him about the state of the French army and French morale at that time?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't think he would have admitted it, and I'm sure I didn't get anything of that sort.
Now, you mention in your book that at the time of this, shortly after the time of this appointment, you spent 5 days at the French 20th Corps headquarters.
Yes.
Which gave you a considerable insight into the French staff system.
Mm.
And you also say it gave you a considerable faith in the French staff system. What interests me is, what aspects of the French staff system impressed you most?
Oh, that... In the British staff system at that time, under the commander, the corps commander, the lieutenant general, he had two co-equal chief staff officers, the brigadier general staff and the administrative Chief of the Administrative Staff, Deputy Adjutant and Quartermaster General, and the CRA, the Commanding Royal Artillery. Really, three co-equal people, all brigadiers. Now, the French system, there was the corps commander, and under him, one chief of staff, under whom were all the subordinates, so that the corps commander only had one staff officer to deal with, whose job it was to pass the commands out to the functioning people below, that is, the general staff who issued the orders and so on, the administrative staff, who again issued orders and their particular job, the administration of the corps, the troops and everything, the supplies and everything, and the CRA, the artillery, the chief engineer, engineering tasks and so on. And the idea, and we have now got that system in the British Army. We took it on. Let's see.
What were the practical disadvantages of the old system?
Well,
under the First World War conditions,
in that the commander, whether it was an army commander, corps commander, division commander, he's the man who should be free to make the big plan, not be worried with details, and yet he had at least four people to deal with, and might have to discuss details with them. Under the French system, he made his big plan, having, from experience, had the experience and the knowledge to be able to make a good plan, and of course he could discuss it with his chief of staff. Then the chief of staff hadn't got the responsibility of making that plan, but his job was to convert that plan into the channels where the details are passed on. So it leaves the big commander, it leaves his brain free to make the big plan.
I see.
Without having to worry about whether so-and-so is doing all the details right.
Can you think of any specific example or any kind of general example that occurred frequently and recurrently of the sort of problems for, say, the corps commander that this system, this staff system that prevailed at the time, created?
Well, you must say the preparations for any big battle. I was thinking when I was in the 15th Corps staff, and we went up to the coast, Newport, Belgian coast, and the plans were being made for an attack on the coastal sector and a landing on the coast in conjunction with the Battle of Ypres. And we still had this system of the several staff officers to deal with the corps commander, you see. Well, I think there it would have our corps commander, Sir John Duquesne, had an extremely able brain. I don't think it worried him, but it would have been probably simpler for him if he had the chief of staff system and could sit back and work out the main problem. And in his case especially, it involved dealing with the navy as well, landing from the sea, dealing with the main liaison with the main attack at Ypres, you see, is a big problem. Well, if you got to deal also with the details of the several divisions under his command, so I think it would have been simpler.
I can see that it was a big problem, or could have been a big problem. I was just wondering whether there were any particular occasions when it actually arose to be a real problem in a very severe practical form.
Well, no.
To illustrate your point.
I think I can't say that any case where it caused a failure of plans.
You said
I should have to delve into my memory. I probably might be able to quote, but then it would probably be quoting some corps commander who wasn't quite up to his job, because it did work. Especially in the latter part of the war, when we were carrying out successful attacks, it did work.
Yes.
But the other system which we have now is more foolproof,
yes.
I think.
In your comments on the staff system,